So far in the story, Satan has appeared before God. God has challenged Satan. Job has been greatly afflicted, losing his possessions, his health, and his children. His friends have journeyed to be with him, and they find him seated in ashes in an unrecognizable state. And in chapter 3, which we're looking at today, Job breaks the silence and speaks. He doesn't speak to his friends. He doesn't speak to God. He is just outpouring his heart. Just outpouring his heart. And there's much to say about this chapter, but to start, I just want to read it. If you remember, Job is meant to be read in its entirety, to be read slowly. We are meant to go down into these depths of sorrow with Job because God did not give us a list of items that help us to handle grief. He gave us a story of a man. And so today, we will read. We're going to start in chapter 2, verse 11, when Job's friends arrive. So follow along in your Bibles. If you do not have a Bible, we have them placed under chairs throughout the seating area there. So please grab one. And if you need help finding Job chapter 3, please ask someone nearby you. I'm going to read starting in chapter 2, verse 11. Now, when Job's three friends heard all this evil that came upon him, they came, each from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. They made an appointment together to come to show him sympathy and comfort him. And when they saw him from a distance, they did not recognize him. And they raised their voices and wept, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights. And no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, "Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said, 'A man is conceived,' let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan. Let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it hope for light, but have none, nor see the eyelids of the morning. Because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not die at birth, come out from the womb and expire? Why did the knees receive me, or why the breast that I should nurse? For then I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept, then I would have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who rebuilt ruins for themselves, or with princes who had gold, who filled their houses with silver. Or why was I not hidden, a stillborn child, as infants who never see the light? There the wicked cease from troubling, and the weary are at rest. There the prisoners are at ease together. They hear not the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter in soul, who long for death, but it comes not, and dig for it more than for hidden treasures, who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find the grave? Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? For my sighing comes instead of my bread, and my groanings are poured out like water. for the thing that I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes." What is the darkest sorrow you have ever known? Where is the deepest pit you have ever been? Whatever that sorrow is, and however deep that pit was, you certainly have no desire to be there again. Today, God's word is taking us to a dark, lonely place. This is the crying out of God's suffering servant. Here we see a man at his absolute lowest state of being. And at the onset, you may already be wondering, why should we linger here? This is dark. It's lonely and it's gloomy. Can't we move on? It is dark. It is gloomy. And God has much to say here. Let's simply make our way through this text, and as we do, we will learn about human suffering. We will learn about the suffering of people. Specifically, we will learn about the suffering of God's people. And we'll see that this text is broken into three sections. You may have picked up on them as I read through it. A curse, a lament, and then a question, a broader question. A curse, a lament, and a question. We're going to first walk through those, and we're going to attempt, through the words on the page, to even begin and try to meet Job where he is. We want to try to begin to grasp the depths of his agony. We want to listen to his words, and when we are all done, we want to ask the question, God, why do we have this? How did this make it into the Bible, and why? What would you teach us here from Job's deep, deep sorrow? Now, we will see from this passage, to show my hand a little bit already, this dark, dark passage, a very profound truth that we do not like, but it is true nonetheless. And it is this. This is my proposition to you today. A genuine child of God may be taken through deep sorrow and grief. A genuine child of God, a faithful child of God, a moral and upright child of God may be taken through deep sorrow and grief. But first, before we look at Job's words, let's notice quickly that he is not alone. This has been a development since our last sermon. His friends have shown up. They come with the best intentions. They come from far away. And their reaction to Job is the beginning of our understanding of Job's grief and sorrow. The setting has much to say about the depths of his misery. We see them arrive in verses 11 through 13 of chapter 2, which I just read. Now, this man, Job, with whom they were not simply buddies, not pals, but friends, committed enough to make a journey from three different lands to come and comfort their friend. This man, Job, was unrecognizable to them. He was unrecognizable to them situationally. He has gone from splendor to squalor. This would be like running into Bill Gates dressed in rags and rooting through a dumpster. Job, who had much and was considered greatest in the land, he is seated on ashes or rubbish, as some translations say. And whether it's garbage or ashes, the point is that it's useless and it has no place in the city or among the living and the healthy and the clean, and neither does Job. He has been reduced. His setting is startling to his friends, but his appearance is as well. This man's health has been compromised in a horrible way. He's afflicted with loathsome sores from head to foot. He is in constant pain and annoyance. The friend they knew was healthy and wealthy. They would meet him joyful in his large home and be attended by his many servants and enjoy a bountiful feast, probably. But now, from a distance, as they make their approach, they can make out the silhouette of a figure seated on the ground, clothes dirty and torn, head crudely shaved, festering sores on all parts of his visible skin. He's been seated there for who knows how long. Long enough for his friends to hear the news of him, take counsel together, plan and make a journey to his land to comfort him, at least that long. And we'll learn from Job's words later that he's already become a reproach to his family, friends, and neighbors. That takes a little bit of time. How long has Job been here? Days? Weeks? Months? Possibly? And so we see that Job's friends begin mourning, not once they are seated with Job. Did you catch that? But once they see Job and they realize that this man has no real place among the living, the Job that they knew is gone. And so they mourn from a distance. Verse 12 of chapter 2, let me reread it to you. When they saw him from a distance, they did not recognize him, and they raised their voices and wept. And they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven. They will mourn with Job in a moment, but it seems at first they mourn over Job. Could this be our friend? This is a different person. Our old friend Job is gone. And so they mourn. And once they are with him, they too take a seat on the ground with Job to mourn with him. And really, this is the best part of their counsel and comfort to Job in the entire story. Once they open their mouths, they just make things worse. For now, though, they are doing well. They are just there. At this point, we can learn a good lesson from Job's friends of just having what we call a ministry of presence and just being there. And they all sit on the dirt because, as Christopher Ashe in his commentary points out, the ground is the place of dust and death. It is the closest men on earth can get to Sheol. It is a physical way to identify with the dead by getting near them in the dust, in the ashes. And so they sit with him in a cultural way of mourning for the dead. And no one spoke a word for 7 days because they saw that his suffering was very great. Now, church, we have the scene in our minds. Let's be an audience to Job's very heart, the heart of God's suffering servant. And as you listen, remember, this is the heart of a child of God. This is the heart of a righteous man. This is the heart of a blameless man. First, Job gives a curse in verses 3 through 10. I won't reread all of it, but let me reread verses 3 through 6. You may read along. Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said a man is conceived. Let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. He doesn't simply say, oh, I wish certain events hadn't happened on that day. He says, let that day perish. Get that day out of here. Job wants to see a blank spot in his calendar where his birthday normally goes. And he uses this effective language of light and darkness. Let that day be darkness, verse 4. Now, a dark day, I'm no astrophysicist or whatever, but a dark day is useless. You can get no work done on a dark day. You cannot travel. You cannot be productive in any way. A dark day, pre-electricity, understand, is a worthless day. And Job is saying, yep, the day I was conceived was in no way beneficial. Better if we hadn't had that day. Let gloom and deep darkness Take it. Let them have it. Let that day be terrified. God in heaven have no part in that day. And here, friends, we begin to see a shift in the man Job from what we've seen up to this point. Now, we love the end of chapter 1. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. So, friends, be like Job and praise God when life turns upside down. Series over, write a popular song about it, the end. Job's initial reaction that we just mentioned is commendable and impressive, and it does speak to us by all means. But Job, now feeling the full fallout of his loss, sitting and thinking in the ashes day after day, has a slight change of demeanor. And while he does not curse the person of God, he does call God's plans and purposes into question by cursing the day of his conception and birth. This is a different side of Job. A man so distraught that after considering what has happened to him and what the rest of his life will probably look like, he says in dark, dark language, "I wish I had never even been." His first words have a nice ring to them. Blessed be the name of the Lord. His next words, not so much. Let the day perish on which I was born. Not as catchy. Meet the new Job. And we've all known this to one degree or another. We've all known how pain and torment bring out a different side of us. Now here we are examining a severe case of this change in Job. So Job curses the day of his birth, the day of his conception, wishing that those days belonged to darkness and death. And then Job moves into a lament in verses 11 through 19. He's not cursing anything at this point. He's not asking for anything. He is simply lamenting. Let me read to you verses 11 through 13 and then also verse 16. 11 through 13. Why did I not die at birth? Come out from the womb and expire. Why did the knees receive me, or why the breasts that I should nurse? For then I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept. Then I would have been at rest. Verse 16. Or why was I not as a hidden stillborn child, as infants who never see the light? In other words, Job is wondering, if this is the purpose of my life, if this is what I'm made for, if my calling in life is to be torn and devastated and sick and alone, if that's why I was born, then why even bother? What is the point? Wouldn't it have been better to just have never been? I'm not convinced this pain in life is worth it. Couldn't I have just died at birth and avoided this whole mess? Have you been there? Have you been alone in the darkness and wondered, if this is what's in store for me, what is the point? I must tell you today that if you find yourself alone and in the dark and wondering what the point of your life is, don't let yourself be alone. God has given us the good gift of Christian brotherhood and the good gift of Christian sisterhood. And you are not meant to suffer alone. We need one another as we suffer, but more on that in a minute. So Job simply laments, and lastly, Job asks a big question. In verses 20 through 26, Job asks a heartfelt question that reveals the depths of where his soul truly is in this moment. Let me read it to you. Verses 20 through 26. Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter in soul, who long for death, but it comes not, and dig for it more than for hidden treasures, who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find the grave? Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? For my sighing comes instead of my bread, and my groanings are poured out like water. For the thing that I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes. And here we begin the why questions of Job. Here Job begins to search for answers. He's not yet addressing God. He is speaking about God, but not to Him yet. And Job is wondering why life is given to the one who longs for death. Let me note quickly that there's no indication here that Job is in any way suicidal. He is accepting what God has given to him. God has given me life and I accept it. I just don't know why He's keeping me around. Now, this is one of the darkest chapters in the Bible. It is certainly the darkest chapter in Job. Let me restate my proposition to you. A genuine child of God may be taken through deep sorrow and grief. God, in His mercy, church, has given us a profound example of one of His children going through deep sorrow and grief, and He has not left us without hope, as we will see. So my proposition, posed in question form, might sound like this. Do you have a category for unexplained suffering? Is there room in your theology for unexplained suffering? I have two short points. And what you're thinking right now is he really just getting to the main points? Well, this is a series on suffering, so that's why I'm just now getting to the points. To give you that dread of how long will he go. I have two short points pertaining to what do we do with Job's lament? What do we do with Job's suffering? How does that speak to us? And it shows us some things. As we consider the truth that children of God will go through suffering, it will be unexplained suffering. My first point is this. Our suffering is not necessarily tied to our circumstances or decisions. Our suffering is not necessarily tied to our circumstances or decisions. We will know suffering. Hopefully not as deeply as Job knew it, but we will know suffering. We need only live long enough. And we need to know, and this is huge, it is possible to suffer innocently. It is possible to suffer innocently. Job suffered innocently. Now, before you jump up out of your seat and the inner John Calvin bursts forth and says, wait a minute, total depravity. Job was not righteous, even Job sinned. So just pause right there. Before that happens, I know that. I know that Job was a sinner in desperate need of God's grace. I know that. The point here, though, is this. According to the mouth of God, Job's suffering was not a result of any sin in Job's life. It was not. It was not a punishment. It was not discipline. God refers to Job as blameless and upright, one who fears God and turns away from evil. Those are God's words, not mine. He said them in chapter 1, verse 8. And again in chapter 2, verse 3, God says that Job's suffering is without reason or without cause, meaning it is not a consequence of anything Job did. Job suffered innocently. And we need to have this category for innocent suffering, because if we don't, we will lose so much time and energy pondering and wondering, how could I have prevented this in my life? Or God, show me the sin that I was committing that caused you to punish me in this way. You can run yourself into the ground pondering those questions, and according to the story of Job, that is not always the case. We need a bigger theology than that when it comes to suffering. Now, there will be suffering in your life and mine that I will never be able to tie to an event, to correlate directly to a sin, a life lesson, or a disciplinary action from God. For purposes unknown to us, sometimes we suffer. Now, Job's friends, we will see, they didn't have this category for innocent suffering, and so they go in circles, chapter after chapter, trying to identify exactly what Job did to deserve this. And God eventually condemns that viewpoint. Friends, Job suffered as one innocent. We see this and we have known this in our own lives. We can't explain the child born with a disease or the young mother taken from her children in her late 20s or the tragedy of fire that leaves a family without a home. We don't always understand the backstory behind suffering, and fortunately, we aren't asked to. Much of our suffering in life will remain a mystery, but no matter how great the mystery of our suffering is, there will always, always be a greater mystery of suffering that should dominate much more of our brain power. The truly innocent one suspended between heaven and earth, absorbing wrath on behalf of those who only deserve judgment. That is a mystery of suffering. In Tim Keller's book, Walking with God Through Pain and Suffering, he describes the different categories of suffering that the Bible presents, and there are several, but let me just paraphrase. There's a general application of the curse of sin. We all know this. Suffering by judgment because of Adam and Eve's choices, there is an unavoidable universal suffering. Sickness exists. Lives end. Relationships suffer. Welcome to a sinful world. And because of the curse, we do see some cause and effect described in places like Proverbs. For example, if I rub poison ivy on my face, it will burn. If you rub poison ivy on your face, it will burn. That's a cause and effect. This is universally applicable and surprises no one. My face is burning. Well, what happened? I rubbed poison ivy on it. Oh, well, yeah, that's what happens. This surprises no one. But then you have another type of suffering, suffering with hidden purpose and suffering surrounded by confusion, like in Job and in Ecclesiastes, where cause and correlations, they are sought, but they are never found. This is the suffering that can't be obviously tied to a choice. The suffering that isn't a direct result of discipline or judgment. Let Job show you that the cause of your suffering may not ever be revealed to you. Job's wasn't. Job suffered innocently and without explanation. And you might too. Keller says this in his book, while the human race as a whole indeed deserves the broken world it inhabits, nevertheless, evil is not distributed in a proportionate, fair way. We see moral people who suffer greatly the entirety of their lives, and we see unrighteous people who seem to have it made in the shade. We can't explain the distribution of suffering, and we aren't asked to. Do you have this category for innocent suffering? When either yourself or someone you know enters into a hardship of some kind, is your first reaction to have to find a reason why? Church, let Job prompt you away from urgently seeking understandable cause and effect in suffering. It is not always there. In fact, it seldom is. Rather, having this category for innocent suffering should prompt us to greater Christian action toward our brothers and sisters who are suffering. Which leads to my second point, and that's that our suffering creates avenues for grace. This is the second thing we can do with Job chapter 3. Our suffering creates avenues for grace. Because without knowing the cause of pain, without tracking down the reason for suffering, without a chapter and verse to support someone's hardships, without all of that, you, Christian, can be a means of grace to a hurting brother or sister in their suffering. More than can, you are asked to. Romans 12, 15 through 16 says this, "Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight." Christian, part of your job description is to come alongside your brothers and sisters, not just when times are good, but in the midst of pain, and to weep with them. Job chapter 3 shows us just how deep that pain and sorrow can go, that we are called to enter, to weep with those who weep. And we don't need answers to their questions. It shows us that we just don't mourn in theory. Job and his grief were real, and so is the need for you to extend comfort to those hurting around you. Christian pain, Christian suffering is a real thing that we will endure until God calls us home. And if we are the ones hurting, we must know some level of openness and vulnerability in our suffering. Don't keep your hurt to yourself. When asked how we're doing, we need a greater inventory of answers than "I'm doing fine, thanks." Or, "Oh, we're doing well, thanks for asking." We need a deeper repertoire of answers. We need honest answers. Now, I'm not saying you need to divulge every dirty secret of your life when you run into each other at the grocery store. But my goodness, could we stand to be more open and trusting with one another? By keeping your pain to yourself, you are robbing your brothers and sisters of the opportunity to be a comforting minister to you, to be a means of grace to you, to follow in obedience to Romans 12. So, let Job chapter 3 give you a category for love and support for your church family. You don't have to have the answers. Can you weep? If you can weep, you can be grace to your brothers and sisters. And 1 Peter 4 tells us that when we serve one another, it is an actual means, an actual channel of God's grace to each other to build up the body. Now, much later in the story, God will speak and he will correct Job and his friends for not having a category for innocent suffering. But please note this. God, even when he speaks harshly, God never condemns Job's grieving. God never corrects Job's lamenting. That should strike us. He doesn't tell Job to rub some tuff on it and move on. It is good to grieve. It is good to be bothered by sickness and death and brokenness. That's a part of what God made us to do. Remember that Jesus himself was torn and grieved and agonized over suffering at the tomb of Lazarus when he cried in the face of death, in the Garden of Gethsemane, and ultimately on the cross as he took the punishment for sinners. Don't run from grief. Rather, take the hands of your Christian family as you wade through it. Let them be grace to you. So, as I conclude, what can we do with this text? How should we act in light of this text? What kind of application can we find, keeping in mind that the children of God can suffer grievously and innocently, and that suffering does create opportunities for grace to one another? Well, first, like we just said, we must develop our category for innocent suffering, and we must be quick to meet one another in suffering. We must be quick to join each other in the depths of sorrow, to sit in the ashes with them, and to probably say nothing. Be quick to say nothing. Be quick to just be there. Be quick to not rely on your wisdom, to not try to solve their problem with a quick verse, because there is no quick verse that solves pain and grief. We must learn to weep with our brothers and sisters. We must be a church that weeps. A church that rallies around our people. A church that puts arms around one another and gives of their time to be with the grieving. A church that prays. That prays over grief and prays over hurt. Let's be that church. I don't want to be the church with all the answers. I want us to be the church that weeps. And that is grace to one another. But second, we must learn to view all of grief and suffering. We have to view all grief and suffering through this lens, the lens of the pinnacle of grief and suffering, the most significant grief and suffering to ever occur. We need to view all suffering through the lens of ultimate suffering. Listen, we'll get there in a moment. If we may look at the text one last time, let's seek to answer this question. About what was Job most grieved? And this is important. About what was he most grieved? Was it the loss of his children? Was it the loss of his possessions or his wealth? Was it the loss of his reputation? Or was it his poor health? It doesn't appear so. Throughout the rest of the story, throughout the rest of the book of Job, the big questions of Job, they don't center around his loss of stuff or relationships. He is grieved for those. Remember the ashes in the morning, his friends sat with him, they mourned for the dead. Rather, Job's biggest concern is that God has cast him aside. That his friendship with God is gone. He will articulate this very clearly in chapters coming, but here in chapter 3, we get the first indication of it. We get the first taste of it. Job 3:23. Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? Whom God has hedged in. A very weak example of this for our understanding would be when a dog senses a distance between them and their master. If you remember Lady and the Tramp, it's fresh on my mind. If you remember Lady and the Tramp, when Jim Deere and Darling are expecting a baby, things become different between them and their dog, Lady. And Lady's wondering, what have I done wrong? Why have they cast me aside? Similarly, but on a much grander scale, Job feels that God is distant. He feels abandoned by God. God has, in Job's mind, hedged him in. Not a hedge of protection, keeping bad things out, but hedged in, meaning unable to move, unable to see, to keep Job subdued and to keep him in the dark. God is done with Job and put him away, Job feels. Now, we know from having the whole story that God is not distant in Job's suffering. We know that. Job has not been abandoned. But Job, in his suffering, feels that God has turned his back on Job and left him to his grief. That's how Job feels right now. He feels that God has hedged him in, and this prospect of losing God's friendship and union is what hurts Job the most. And this problem will inform his questions for the chapters to come. For the thing that I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. Job feels abandoned by God. What does this have to do with our application? Listen, Job's question, "Where are you, God?" is not the most profound use of this question in the Bible. There is a greater time that this question is asked, and it's asked by another sufferer who was truly innocent, who cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Job wished for a day of deep darkness, and on a day of actual deep darkness, there was not a perceived abandonment by God, but an actual abandonment by God as the Son hung on a cross alone and fully scorned. How amazing it is that though we at times feel abandoned by God in our suffering, it is through the suffering and abandonment of Jesus that we might actually know God. Do you see the tremendous cosmic irony? That as Job felt abandoned and cried out because of it, feeling he was distant from God, it was the one Job pointed to, the true greater suffering servant, that through his abandonment would draw others close to God. And every time Job or you or I feel abandoned by God, who, by the way, has promised to never leave us. Our minds and hearts must default to the hours that Jesus Christ suffered in actual abandonment for us as God turned away and could not look on the sin that Jesus bore. Let your mind go there. Because that moment of suffering was and is the solution to all suffering. Because God the Son has suffered in the place of lawbreakers and rebels like us, we might know an eternity absent of suffering with Him. He who died, yes, but who rose again, stamping His seal of ownership on death itself. And He will one day return to bring us to Himself and to His new heavens and new earth where there is no death and there is no suffering. And only then will pain and grief become obsolete and irrelevant. Friend, if this is news to you, that you might be welcomed by God into His love and into His eternity where there will be no tears, if that is news to you, I am so glad you are here. Are you trusting this work of Jesus for your good standing with God? Do you hate your sin and desire to live a life for your Creator, God in heaven? Nothing else will suffice. Nothing else can defeat your suffering. You can know this salvation today. And I would love personally the opportunity to talk with you more about the God who saves through the suffering of His Son, Jesus. Will you please bow your heads with me and pray? Father in heaven, we love You and we thank You for the love that You have for Your children. Thank You for not basing Your favor for us upon our own abilities or achievements. Jesus Christ, thank You for enduring solitude and punishment so that we might know God. We love You for it, and we desire to live our lives in service to You. Help us. Spirit of God, thank You for making us alive to the truth of the gospel. Thank You for the new life that You give. Spirit, for those here who do not know salvation, who do not know forgiveness of sins, would You draw them near? Would You work in their hearts to hear and believe Your wonderful gospel? We are asking You to do what only You can do by Your magnificent power. And we pray in the name of Jesus to the glory of the Father. Amen.